Welcome to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast, the show that explores the background of Tolkien's amazing world from the very beginning. In a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. I've heard it said that among writers, one of the most important things to do with your story is to focus on the very first sentence and the very last sentence of the story. And I have to wonder, how much did J.R.R. Tolkien focus on this? I know that he was a stickler for basically every word that went into anything that he wrote. So he would have fussed a bit about pretty much everything. But I have to wonder, did he put extra emphasis on figuring out what would be the very first line and the very last line of his stories? And my guess here with The Hobbit, at least with this line, is that it just came to him. And it was perfect when it did. I mentioned in the last episode that as he was grading some papers, he just jotted this line down. So it did just come to him, but I think it survived from that moment on to the final version of the book. In Hole in the Ground, there lived a hobbit. Not a nasty, dirty, wet hole filled with the ends of worms and an oozing smell, nor yet a dry, bare, sandy hole with nothing in it to sit down on or to eat. It was a hobbit hole, and that means comfort. In the very first line here, he's doing something very specific. He's subverting our expectations. And we already get a few things that play out in this very first paragraph that set the tone and the expectations for this story. We have the voice of the author. And this author's voice is very specific to The Hobbit. There's this thing we do with language where the words we choose and how we choose to present ideas can betray our perspective on the person that we're talking to. If I decide that I want to explain things in very simplistic terms, then it's assumed that the person I'm talking to is either a novice at the very thing that I'm talking about, or is also very young. That seems to be the case here, and we get that from the very first paragraph. The assumption here is that if you were to say, in a hole in the ground, there lived something or somebody, and then you had to follow that up with saying, well, no, it's not a hole, like a wet one with a bunch of worms in it, or a dry one like you would just dig a hole in the sand. It was a comfortable hole, a hobbit hole. Now, clearly this narrator is addressing an audience that is not familiar with hobbits yet, because this is the first time the word hobbit is used anywhere. So clearly the audience will be novices when it comes to hobbits. But there's also something about this that seems to already be focusing on this idea that the audience is young. Just because you claim something lives in a hole doesn't necessarily mean that it's wet and gross or dry, like a hole in the sand. But the narrator here is assuming that those are the two options that the person reading this will jump to. So, in that case, it appears that they're already addressing you, the reader, as if you are a young person. And this expands throughout the story. The narrator often does present things in a way where it feels like a parent reading a book to a child, or at least a caregiver reading the book to the child, and trying to bring them up to the information level that they would need in order to understand things, and to do it in a playful and yet gentle and sometimes teasing kind of way, the way that would be fun for children in order to keep them engaged. And speaking about keeping them engaged, we already see that there's a method that Tolkien is using here in order to do that. It's to subvert expectations. From the very first paragraph of this book onward, Tolkien is subverting expectations, not just with what type of hole a hobbit would live in, but in the way that this book works altogether. He already understood that somebody coming to read this book would see it as a fairy tale. And as a fairy tale, they would have certain expectations about it. And he's going to subvert those expectations around almost every corner. The very next paragraph has a description of what the hole is like, with a bunch of different items detailed in very specific ways in order to give us a visual perspective on this hobbit hole. And it's described in a way that would both, again, appear very familiar to somebody of Tolkien's time, but also distinctly different and unique. It starts with a porthole door, perfectly round, painted green, with a shiny yellow brass knob exactly in the middle. And yet, for as familiar as a shiny brass knob and a green painted door might be to somebody of Tolkien's time, or even somebody today, it's round. And the knob is in the very center of this big round door. It's kind of odd. Wouldn't you put the knob toward one of the sides in order to better leverage the movement of the door and get out of the way when you want to open it? But no, it's in the middle, which I think does a thing here that accentuates the roundness of the door and the tunnel that this leads into. And again, he subverts our expectations. A very comfortable tunnel without smoke, with paneled walls and floors tiled and carpeted. Notice that he has to point out here, without smoke. And so I have to wonder about that. Did most people expect holes in the ground to have smoke coming out of them, even when they are designed for the occupation of people? It's a strange thing to point out, right? It's a little bit odd. Then he goes on and talks about the polished chairs and lots of pegs for hats and coats. And notice the repetition of lots. This is something he would know would be stricken out. If you were somebody who was just writing a description of a room, repeating the word lots is unnecessary. Why do that? Unless the tone is for children. We do things like this when we talk to children. Oh, there's lots and lots of birds in the sky. Like that kind of thing, right? That's the tone with which we speak to children. And then he tells us the hobbit was fond of visitors, which I think from the very beginning makes us want to like this specific hobbit. He might be the kind of hobbit that would be excited to see us come by for tea or a meal, which we're about to find out there are many in a day. And then we get a description of the hill itself, something with an official name. This isn't just a random hole in the ground that a hobbit happens to live in. No, there is a community here who recognizes this as a named place. This is the kind of place that you would live in if you were a landowner. And it's fancy. And you would expect, again, subverting expectations, that a fancy landowner would live in a place with multiple stories, multiple floors in their home. But because this is dug into the ground, there are not multiple stories. Instead, there are multiple rooms that all basically come off of this one main hallway. And of course, all the good rooms are focused on the left side that butt up against the edge of the hill so that they could have windows that look out to the gardens that let light in to this underground abode. So he's, again, subverting expectations in that way too. This isn't just a hole that goes down into the ground. This is a place that is lit with sunlight, just like any of us would want in our own homes. And he lists out all the different kinds of rooms, including multiple pantries, which he's getting to in a minute about why that is. And then tells us that the Hobbit was very well-to-do, which had been implied up until this point, but is now very firmly stated. And his name was Baggins. That's the last name of the individual. And at this time in history, that's what would have been most important. You would say, oh, that man's name is Baggins. John Baggins or whatever, right? But we know this is Bilbo. The Bagginses had lived in the neighborhood of the Hill for time out of mind, and people considered them very respectable. And this is a cornerstone of what we know about Bilbo. This right here, right in the very beginning of this story, tells us that this is a character who is supposed to be and expected to be very respectable. Not because they're rich, but because they've never had any adventures or did anything unexpected. This is a social pressure sort of thing. This is also setting up what is about to happen. This is a character at the beginning of a fairy tale story. You would expect that character at the beginning of the fairy tale story would go on an adventure. But guess what? This one is respectable and has been for generations and is very comfortable and is wealthy and is living in a home that many people know about. The whole community knows about the Hill. And this character never goes on adventures at all. You can see how this is playful and clearly meant, or at least written in a way that you would read something like this to children, because even children pick up on this idea of stating a thing and then getting the opposite. We're told that Bilbo Baggins here lives in a hole. Yeah, but it's not what you would expect. And we're also told that he's a respectable sort, and that specifically means the kind of person who does not go on adventures. Yeah, all of a sudden, we start to doubt that, because we've already been told from the beginning to doubt our expectations. And then it clearly says here, this is a story of how a Baggins had an adventure and found himself doing and saying things altogether unexpected. And now the scene is set. What is the adventure? Where is he going? What kinds of things would somebody like this do and say that are unexpected? In our current world, this would have been the clickbait title of the video. But in this world, where novels are long and verbose, and you would have had to get through at least a few paragraphs before getting here, this is kind of the equivalent. This is the setup and then the turn. This is the thing that's going to hook us and make us want to read through the rest of the story to find out, what exactly does Bilbo get up to? And then if that wasn't enough, the very next sentence says, he may have lost the neighbor's respect, but he gained, well, you will see whether he gained anything in the end. A little bit of teasing, a little bit of hinting at, well, I'm not going to give everything away. You're going to have to get through the story to find out the rest. And I have to wonder, when Tolkien got to this moment, at the very beginning of this story, which he probably wrote down fairly quickly. It feels kind of fast and loose, because Bilbo here is described in a way that I don't know if after reading through the entire story, I would have described him in this way later on. The idea that he likes to have lots of visitors. The Bilbo after this story doesn't seem to really like to have lots of visitors. You know, at the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, he's kind of frantic and complaining about the party and everybody being there. But I think he still enjoyed interacting with other people, so maybe that would be true. But we get this very vague hint, this little tease that, well, we'll just have to see. And he did lose his neighbor's respect. And I have to wonder, was this edited later? Was this just written in at the beginning of the story before Tolkien knew where the story was going in the long term? Did he have an understanding of where things would actually end up and which things would be changed about Bilbo in the end beyond just the respect of his neighbors? I'm not sure. But then he gets into a little bit more detail here. And again, the author has this really peculiar kind of tone. This next paragraph, the author begins describing this hobbit's mother, the mother of our particular hobbit, and then cuts off. What is a hobbit? As if the person reading this in that moment got a question from the audience and it sidetracked the conversation. And then they go, oh, I suppose hobbits need some description nowadays. And then goes on describing hobbits. And we find out things about them. But notice that that was not the author's initial intent here in this paragraph. It was more about describing the mother of the hobbit. Why describe the mother here, or the father, or the family, or anything like that, unless it is important to the previous point, and it follows logically from that. We're being told about Baggins and not wanting to go on adventures and things like that, and then all of a sudden we get a description of the mother, almost, but then they back up and say, oh, well, I have to describe hobbits first. Then we can talk about where this hobbit comes from in their family and get more into their particular personality. Because later on, we find out that this hobbit's mother was Beldonna Took. And Beldonna Took, maybe I should say Took, was somebody who would have gone on adventures. And so even though this character is descended from their father also, and the Baggins name, which means respectability, there's something in the genetic makeup here that means that Bilbo might not be everything that he looks from the outside. Again, subversion of expectation, but in this paragraph, they're even subverting the flow of the conversation. Because, oh yeah, you still don't know really what a hobbit is. But we'll get to that when we get back from the break. We gotta go thank our patrons. Thank you for being here. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. It's that time. Holiday shopping is here, and I've got something to help you out. Uncommon Goods takes the stress out of gifting with thousands of unique, high-quality finds you won't see anywhere else. And that's legit. How many different stores can you find exactly the same products and you just are shopping for whoever has the best deal? No, this is a place that has high-quality, unique, often handmade or made in the US products by independent artists and small businesses that truly create one-of-a-kind gifts for all sorts of different seasons, and it's the holiday season. Well, get this. I found one that I thought was super cool. Now, my wife loves puzzles. She loves mysteries. She loves escape rooms. They have murder mystery jigsaw puzzles where you use the puzzle to solve the mystery. There's a few of these, and I think I might pick up the clairvoyant convention one. I think she'll love it. And that's just one example. They've got gifts for moms and teens, book lovers, history buffs, diehard football fans, foodies, mixologists, gardeners. There's something here for everybody on your gift list. And they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice with every purchase. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So don't wait. Cross those names off your list before the rush. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/ringslore. That's uncommongoods.com/ringslore for 15% off. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary. I love it when the show gets really cool sponsors. And this time is no different. A brand new audiobook for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone is available now with, and get this, Hugh Laurie as Albus Dumbledore. Yes, Dr. House as Dumbledore. Now, you know me, I love fantasy stories. I love The Lord of the Rings. I love stories like Harry Potter, which were highly influenced by stories like Lord of the Rings. But listening to an audiobook version of this with Hugh Laurie and a cast of all of these different characters and actors who you might actually recognize. Matthew McFadden as Voldemort, Riz Ahmed as Severus Snape, Michelle Gomez as Professor McGonagall, Mark Addy as Rubius Hagrid, Kush Jumbo as the narrator, and that's just the beginning of the cast. Keira Knightley as Professor Umbridge, James McAvoy as Mad-Eye Moody, Kit Harington as Professor Lockhart, and get this, probably my favorite out of all of these, Matt Berry as Sir Cadogan, and Simon Pegg as Arthur Weasley. There's an entire new musical score, and you'll hear sound effects like echoes in hallways of footsteps and the golden snitch buzzing past your head. Imagine listening to this with earbuds in. And it's out now on Audible. So all you have to do is go to audible.com/HP1 for Harry Potter. Again, that's audible.com/HP1. It's Harry Potter like you've never heard it before. Listen on Audible. Listen now. All right, thank you for being here for our first very close read episode of The Hobbit. I am so excited to get into this. And if this is slow going, then yeah, it is. I'm going to take a look at every paragraph, at every word, and I won't be reading them all out. So please feel free to have a book open or previously read this before the episodes so that you know what I'm talking about when I reference things. But yeah, we're going real deep. We're going real slow, and I'm going to point out every little detail that makes this book so good. So thank you for being here. I also have to shout out our patrons, our newest patrons, Austin D and Alex T. Welcome to the Patreon. So glad that you are here. And I have to shout out our VIP patrons. So here we go. AK Music Lover, Apollo, Aragorn III, Alte Morton, Austin C, Azul Razzle, Barney D, Bo, Black Swirl, Brandy D, Cutter Metalworks, Daniel Nightweaver, David S, David M, Divine Madman, Fulcrum, Gimli A Break, Gemma D, Jesse P, Jezzer, Kate or Katie S, Capenna, Lori B, Mason Weathertop, Michael M, Nick K, Nostrils of Sauron, Richard J, Rivqua, Rosie Rose, Sam B, Seju, TJT, I almost got to the, I was so close, and Tour Son of Four. Thank you so much for all of your support and for keeping this going and getting to the point where we can talk about The Hobbit. This is so fun. If you'd like to check out everything on the Patreon, including bonus episodes, and the bonus episode this week, at least this is my plan right now, is to talk a little bit more in detail about the actual design of the hill, of Bilbo's home, because there are descriptions and maps, and there's other perspectives on what this might actually look like. And we get like the movie versions, we get the book version. I want to go into what the design of this house may have actually been like. So come back for that if you're signed up on the Patreon and you get access to the bonus episodes. All of that is available at patreon.com/LOTRLorecast. So go check it out, and thank you to everybody for your support. Also, I have to read out some reviews, but I don't have any new reviews. So if you would like to get your words on the show, then leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, and I'll read it out on a future episode. Plus, you can rate the show on Spotify. 5 stars on Spotify is huge. It's a huge help. Also, you can share this with your friends if you know the people who are into The Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit or The Rings of Power show, and they want to know more about this wonderful, crazy, amazing world. Please share the show with them. Thank you for all of the support. All right, let's go on and get back to the story. Here we go. Okay, so what is a hobbit? We get a description here, and this is the first description we get, and it's something that absolutely sticks, and I think it sticks for a few different reasons. First of all, we're told that they are rare and shy of people. They've become rare and shy of people, and they call us the big people, and they or were a little people. Notice the or were here. They are or were a little people. But didn't the previous sentence just tell us that they have become rare and shy of the big people, meaning that they should still be around? But now this next sentence implies that they may not be, that they either disappeared or somehow got bigger over time. Right here, they are or were a little people. It's implying one or the other. And it tells us a little bit more about half our height and smaller than the bearded dwarves, as if we're supposed to already be familiar with the bearded dwarves and know who these are or how tall they actually are or anything like that. So all of a sudden we get a description about dwarves. We know dwarves exist in this reality, along with hobbits, and they should be more familiar to us than hobbits. And yet, hobbits have no beards, and there is little or no magic about them. Except, and this is another interesting point, except the ordinary everyday sort which helps them to disappear quietly and quickly when large stupid folk like you and me come blundering along, making a noise like elephants which they can hear a mile off. And the tone here is, again, silly. There's kind of this comedic, funny tone to this. This idea that, well, we're the big people, we're loud like elephants to them, which emphasizes how small they are, because if we're like elephants, they must be pretty tiny. But I think the more interesting point here is about magic. They have no, or little or no magic about them. And remember from our conversations a long time ago about the nature of magic in Tolkien's work, that this is talking about something that is inherent to who they are. This isn't stated in a way where it says something like, they could cast little or no magic spells. No, there is little or no magic about them. They themselves appear natural to our world, just like you and I do, for the most part, except that they can disappear quietly and quickly. There's something that's a little bit, you could say, magical or even supernatural about that one quality about them, which both sets them apart from us, but also means that they are a little bit fantastic. They're a little bit fantasyful. They come slightly from this land of fairy in a way that's different from you or me. And then we're given some humorous little details here. Things like, they incline to be fat in the stomach, which, again, children, I think, would giggle at. That is supposed to be a line that's not only descriptive of hobbits, but also shows them to be fairly sedentary, and they enjoy their food. They're a comfortable people. They dress in bright colors, chiefly green and yellow. Okay, so they wear bright colored clothes. They seem kind of jolly, maybe even. Maybe we associate jolly with fat stomach, with like Santa Claus, something like that. But then we're told that they wear no shoes. They do not wear shoes, and they have leathery soles with hair on top of their feet that's like the hair on the top of their heads. And again, I have to wonder, why include these details other than just showing how different they are than humans? And by include these details, I mean write these in, create this as something that is definitive of this species of people, other than to both make them seem a little comical, walking around without shoes, like children like to do when they run around outside, but then to have hair on top of their feet that's like the hair on the top of their heads. There's something that's kind of silly about that. And for the most part, their hair is curly, which a lot of people's is, so that would feel familiar. And they have long, clever, brown fingers. Notice the use of brown here. And again, I'm not 100% sure why you would define the fingers as brown. He's not talking about their skin color in general tends to be brownish. He's saying that they have clever brown fingers. I have to wonder if that means the kinds of hands that are used to working with dirt or clay, the kinds of hands that would have been stained by the making or the creating or the farming of things. Good-natured faces and the laugh, deep, fruity laughs. And I think there's probably something in the use of fruity here that was from Tolkien's time and place, because I don't think many of us would describe somebody with a deep, fruity laugh. But here it is. And again, I think there's something warm and friendly about that. And then we find out more about their eating practices, especially after dinner, which they have twice a day when they can get it. I think this is another one of those moments where Tolkien is writing and he knows that he's writing to children. So he's subverting expectations in a humorous way. What child would ever imagine somebody having a second dinner? That's hilarious. That's so weird. Maybe that's why they have big bellies. Ha ha ha. Right? This seems to be what he's doing here. And yet these become characteristics of hobbits from this point on. Now, we also have to think about what he sees as being the future direction of the story at this point. These are people who are comfortable. They have qualities about them that make them the kind of people that you would feel, or you or I, or whoever is reading this book, would feel comfortable around. They're sure, they're little, and they've got this slight bit of magic about them, but they like eating a good meal or two. They've got big bellies. They have friendly, good-natured faces. Tolkien is doing the thing that is done in fairy stories and myths, where you start with something that feels normal, something that feels comfortable, a place that you can connect to, a character that you can identify with, even though he's different than you and me in certain regards. He's similar enough that we can identify. And in the ways that this Baggins is different, it's fun. He's the kind of person who's different in a way that makes us curious, that we would want to spend time with him and learn more about him. He's not scary. He's not dangerous. And yet, Tolkien knows at this point that that is exactly where the rest of the story will go. We are given a moment of comfort and connection with a character that we, the readers, can identify with. Somebody who's good-natured, who lives in a nice home, in a nice place, on a nice day, who's about to go on an adventure. And the world out there is not like where he comes from in multiple different ways. Where he comes from, it's safe and comfortable. The world out there is dangerous. Where he comes from, it's kind of like our world. If you were to take the description of the Hobbit Hole and just read it out to somebody in the 1930s or 1940s, they wouldn't have known that this was the kind of dwelling that somebody would have lived in, either in a different world, let alone just a different time and period of history. This description of a home could have been the kind of place somebody lived in the 1930s. It just happened to be underground. Even today, yeah, there's no description of computers or TVs in the rooms or air conditioning, but aside from those little details, he's living in a place that feels modern. This society that the hobbits live in is basically a modern society, a modern agrarian society, but it doesn't feel ancient, and yet it is. And it stands apart from the rest of the world that we're about to see, because the world beyond the Shire feels much more ancient. And maybe that's a little, I don't know if anachronistic is the right word, this idea to have the Shire and the places that the hobbits come from feeling a little bit more modern, but not so much in a way where it would be impossible. We don't see modern technology. They're not using radios and televisions. So it's close enough to this ancient-seeming world without seeming impossible. And I think there's something clever about that. So if there's any major takeaway from this part of the book, from the very beginning of the book, it's the subverting of expectations. What kind of book are we even reading? Who even are these people? What is this place? All of those things are being turned on their head right from the beginning. And that does this thing that causes the audience, you and me or children or whoever happens to be reading this book, to want to dig in a little bit more. Oh, that's odd. That seems curious. Well, what even is going to happen next? Where are they? What even are hobbits? Where is the story going? And we'll pick it up next week with details about Bilbo's parents and Gandalf and so much more. I'm so glad that you are here. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next time. And if you're venturing from your hobbit hole, stay safe out there. It's a mysterious and dangerous world.
Thanks for listening to the Lord of the Rings Lorecast. If you'd like to learn more about other fantasy worlds, check out my other podcasts, The Elder Scrolls Lorecast, The Witcher Lorecast, and more at robotsradio.net. If you'd like to reach out, I'd love to hear from you. Send me a note on Twitter at robots_radio, or join our amazing community on the Robots Radio Discord. There are links in the show notes, or just search Robots Radio Discord, or find the link on robotsradio.net. I'll see you next time.